Welcome to the Order of Time. Today, I would like to talk to you about discrimination. Sooner or later, do we have, with our democracies, elections. These elections prove that we discriminate between political, societal interests. This discrimination is usually cutting on the dimension of left and right wing politics and politicians. There's this leftish interest, which is democratic, social, equal-minded, in the sense of community services, healthcare for everyone, social security, and the communal interest, as opposed to the individual interest. One fights individualism as a kind of evil at the left side. This is a nightmare to the right side, who does the opposite. And they say, well, it is about self-realization, but you have to take your own responsibility. You won't have a state that cares for you. Don't think about what the state does for you. Think about what you can do for the state. This is an authoritative position in which one dreams of the king, of being the king, of becoming the great noble who has the estate. You conquer your territory, and the rest may sit in an apartment building. You have conquered the estate, and the rest are your subjects. You are the king, and they are the lesser ones. You are have the grace of God, and the rest is just ignorant and too stupid to achieve what you achieve. But, okay, this is a bit an old-fashioned concept of order, which is historically of a lot of warfare. There, in the old Roman Republic, we had this opposition already between the emperor and the republic. And republicans say, okay, we don't want these nobles, but we do want the estate. We do want these riches. We do want this material wealth as a complement of our virtuous religiosity. And we don't want to be called nobles, no. It is enough to have this estate. In other words, one wants to acquire possessions but not really carry the responsibility of the nobility. Because that might be a migraine. One might have a headache of being attached to matter and while at the same time representing God in society. Yeah? The nobles are known for having this migraine, this chronic headache of a conflict between spiritual integrity of relating to God and material control, because these things do not always harmonize. So this is an essential point of discrimination in society, this left and this right wing mentality. But when we have elections, we tend to arrive sooner or later at a cabinet of ministers and a senate of representatives who have to function as one integral whole. One has to be an integrity of rule. People need an integrity of rule, not to be divided, not to fight amongst each other. So one has to compromise. Left and right, just like the left and right hand in the body, have to be coordinated by a kind of heart, by a kind of brain, by a kind of consciousness. There has to be a kind of integrity to this discrimination between these opposing, seemingly opposing interests. So there's more needed. These days we are dealing with the world culture, with the pressure to arrive at a common interest, at a common culture which may cover the entire world. This is a globalist interest, which also is a political issue. Some are against it, some are in favor of it, some want it a different way. There must be globalization, but must we do this with a business mind only? Business is necessary. There's always business. There's always selling and buying, and an economy of distributing capital subjected to certain norms and standards of how people should earn that money. That is always so. That will always be so. But is it enough to cover this integrity of culture that we need to live peacefully and still be ourselves, still be free in our choice, also politically? And because we do not want a repressive system in the sense of a capitalist dictature, just as we don't want to have a communist dictature fighting it, nor do we want a fundamentalist dictature or a nationalist fascist dictature of militaristic plans to destroy anyone not of our civilization or our race. These kinds of dictatures we don't want. These are perversions of the, of our political positions, as we explained before, in the fields of action. So we discriminate between left and right, between the individual material interest and the more social democratic interest, which is closer to an ideal which would serve everyone but goes at the cost of this individuality. So we have this essential left-right difference, which in the fields of action opposes with the notion of quantity, individuality opposed to the social. So we have this essential discrimination. But if you want to arrive at a government of unity, at a world government of unity, at a United Nations which is properly functioning without conflict, so that everyone knows his place and as well is in service with the system that we have then. If you want to arrive at such an integrity, we need a few terms more. If we are sober and we look simply at our own culture in our own dictionaries, we see that there's not only English words anymore in the dictionary. The English language has absorbed from other cultures other terms. The strength of the English language consists of the ability to absorb terms of other cultures. So the world culture, the dominating language, is at the moment English. That is why I speak English. Even though I am a Dutchman, I speak English. And I try to keep the balance between my own tongue, to be adapted to my own place, and at the same time communicate our own integrity with abroad in English. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm communicating the Dutch integrity of discriminating things politically but also spiritually to the rest of the world. And in this context, I say, well, we are dealing with a cultural integrity which is there already. It's not that I want to create this. No, it is something I soberly notice. We have these strange words, or not so strange words anymore, in our own dictionary. The English dictionary from the East, because English is a Western language, but we were colonies and we colonized the East, India, for instance, England, the English, colonized India. And as a consequence of that, we have adopted in our language a few of these Hindu words. We cannot say any longer that Hinduism is a primitive religion of superstitious people, of idol worship, who never arrive at an integrity of Christian supremacy like we have. No, this is not true. The Hindus are not inferior to us. Tomorrow they supersede us in our control. They buy our businesses, just like the Japanese. The Eastern culture is not backward at all. No, they are catching up with our materialism, and they prove that they can be just as well the same materialist as we are. Our material control is not superior to theirs. They simply take some time to absorb that in their own culture, at the same time taking with them the strength of their culture, which is building on certain concepts which we have learned to accept in our own language. We are not strange to that anymore. We are not negative about that anymore. It is part of our culture. It is in our dictionaries, evidently present as a few words meaningful to us, as a few words to which we do not have directly an English equivalent. These words are the terms of yoga, karma, and dharma. So if you look in the dictionary, you see these words as English. It is an English word to say yoga. Everybody knows what you talk about. If you say you have bad karma, karma is a normal English word these days, even though it is not an originally Western term. It is an imported term. It is an absorbed, integrated term. So we are yoga, we are karma, and we also have dharma. Dharma, the religiosity, the righteousness, the proper path, the proper conduct we need to arrive at that soul and to get rid of that karma. So we have these three basic terms which further are necessary to arrive at an integral rule, at a proper government, at a proper state order, at a proper order of United Nations. We cannot do without the Eastern culture. We have elected a new president of the United Nations, the world president, and it is a man from South Korea. It is an Eastern person. So the world culture is integrated already. It is not a point of ambition that I want to attain this, I want to create this. No, it is more a matter of consciousness. Are we aware of the contents of our cultural integration as it is now? That is the point I want to make now at this moment concerning the concept, the subject of integration and discrimination. And we discriminate these certain terms because we do not have proper English equivalents for them. And this discrimination is essential to arrive at this order, and also the order of time we've been defending in our previous talks as well. So let me further dilate about these basic terms that we assimilated and that we have integrated in our own culture, English and all. Even though I'm not English, that doesn't matter. I speak English, I am English, I am European, I am a world citizen equal to any other world citizen, to an Eastern person, to a Chinaman, to an American. We are equally positioned citizens in the world community. So globalization is not an ideal, it is a fact. And there might be political struggle about who wins this game, about who ends up in the apartment building and who will inherit the estate. But this is a political issue. Of course, there must be some reward for taking the burden, for taking this load. But there must also be set a limit. In concrete terms, you could say everybody is entitled to a backyard, to a piece of this earth, but not everybody can have an estate. That is too predator-minded. If you want to have a hunting ground, and if you say this is my health and this is my wealth, and everybody should acquire it, then you must also say this is not possible, because for such a lifestyle we need at least 1,000 planets like the Earth to populate it as we do now, with this ambition. So this is not a viable option. This is not possible for us to state as an ideal that everybody would acquire an estate, a big salary, more than we need, and more than 10 times Social Security. Yeah, that would be too much. We count from 0 to 10, and that's the level of appreciation you can acquire. If you score a 10, that's the maximum. If you score a 0, that's the lowest you can get. So 0 is no income at all. One might be a social security check, and two might be a normal income of people doing simple work. And three might be a more educated approach with some more experience and some more career, etc., etc., until you end up with 10. And so 10 times social security would be enough for a salary as a world order, just to keep us motivated, also in a material sense, but at the same time set limits, because this is only one planet, and we didn't have the notion of constructing vimanas or flying saucers yet to attain to other planets. So we can't reach at other planets, and if we could reach it, the chances are slim that we could land there and root there. So just like seeds produced from a flower that had its bloom and is now seed in the wind, so a culture may die on a planet and produce seed pods going elsewhere. But this is not the case as yet with our world culture. First, we need to flower this flower properly and be realistic that with the number of people we have on this planet, you may be glad to have your own backyard. Because, for instance, if you look in New York, you may be glad to have in the cellar a little bit of place to put your bike, and that's all the ground you have under your feet. Especially in cities, one realizes that this ambition to have an estate is a dream which is not possible. This is not a viable option for the world order. One can have maybe a bigger backyard, but we cannot have a castle anymore with a big estate around it. We should share this planet and not be destructive in envy with each other. So this greedy approach is not viable, even though we can have some incentives in the form of different economic positions we may acquire. The integrity of the world order, associating with these matters of politics, may only be properly understood if we accept these terms of dharma, karma, and yoga. So let me explain on these terms further. Why would these terms be needed in our culture? What is so essential about it? And why do we not have our own equivalents for that? So if you take yoga, yoga means to unify, if you look in the dictionary. But it cannot be translated simply with unification, because there's also sexual unification. You can unite in a sexual act, in making love, you unite. But that's a physical effort to unite. In physical uniting, bodily uniting, you realize that you are creating something. It is a procreative act. You make a baby, and you cannot do that all the time. You can do that for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, so now and then, but then you're separate beings again, and this unification might be your lust and your life, but it is not something that is the unification that would work for all. It wouldn't work for children, it wouldn't work for the old age who have had their time in this respect. So unification is not the proper translation for what we have in mind to get a better culture, a better integration of culture at a mondial scale and also nationally. So we have this term of yoga. It means unification, but it means more than just unification. It is the unification of consciousness. We unify not so much in the body. Yogis might have a sexual life, but that is another type of sexuality. And then we call it tantra. Then the yoga is meditating for the unity of the spirit, not so much for the unity of being in touch with each other's body. The body is just a gate for this spiritual communion, for the spiritual union. which is a preparation for this pure unification in the soul. Because in matter, in the material world, we cannot really unify. On the material plane, you cannot really unify. If you try to, you make babies or you make war. You make love or you make war. And that is not a unification that we talk about and that we need. You know, we had to accept this word of yoga in our dictionaries because this unification must be of the consciousness. So the science of unifying oneself in the consciousness is what we call yoga. And this is an essential term, which means more this than just unification. It means more than just doing some physical exercises to prepare for that unification. The unification in the soul is what the essence of yoga is. Irrespective of the exercises you do, because some do prayers and some do physical exercises and some do both. That is all yoga. That is what we should know. That we have an essential term in our dictionaries, which is not another culture. This is our own English language, our own world, present world language. Yoga is there for the Chinese, for the Russians, for the Europeans, the North and the South Americans, and also for the Africans. Yoga is there for everyone because it's simply a normal word, just as God. You believe in it or not, but it's an essential term used by half the world population in many respects. So the word of God cannot be excluded from the dictionary. And so also we have this term of yoga, which is closely associated with this interest of God. Many people use the term God. And in yoga we unify in the soul, which has as its original order this nature, this concept of God. God applies to the complete of the soul, while the individual soul is the desire to attain to that Godhead, to that completeness. So you cannot separate yoga from God either. You cannot say yoga is just a science of controlling the consciousness and the body, and then you're done. No, it is more connoted than that. It is connoted with the entirety of Hindu philosophy, which is wider than yoga. Yoga, in the narrow sense, is just one of the six disciplines of India that we cover also in our philognosy, because we are not just yoga, but yoga is an essential part of it. The spiritual part, the central spiritual part about principles and transcendence is the science of yoga. So this about the term of yoga. So we have two other terms that we assimilated in our culture. That is the term of karma and dharma. Karma, everybody knows. So let me tell you about these terms further. Karma, we had to accept this term because it is a complex term. It means a lot, not just work, because if you look in the Sanskrit dictionary, you can translate the word karma with work. Everybody has work, everybody has karma. But karma is more than that. Karma also means work load, the consequence of your actions, the profit-minded action, the fruitive activities. You work for a result, for an outcome. This type of connotation is what the term karma means. It is not just working, because you can work for God or work for the devil or work for the gold. You can do any type of work, but that doesn't describe properly what karma all means. Karma means specifically the workload, the desire to have results, to make profit, to have a certain advantage over others. This is karma. This is a load which might burden your conscience. You have a hundredfold salary compared to someone living on a social security check, while you serve God in no way, while that person with a security check serves God all day. So what is the best worker? And who would deserve what? So Jesus said, okay, my kingdom is not of this earth, nor do I desire a hundredfold income. But we have to say that even though we want to have some difference in income, to be stimulated and rewarded, we have to accept a certain righteousness, a certain dharma to this karma. This desire to acquire and to carry such a material burden is what we call karma. And karma as a burden also means a load that you carry, which you cannot so easily shake off. It is to be combined with yoga in the sense of karma yoga, that you understand how these terms practically work. If the load is too heavy, if you want to be happy, you have to get rid of your karma. You have to do sensible work to convert this karma into akarma. Akarma doesn't mean unemployment, it means devotional service. It means what you do at Sundays. You go singing together and read in the Bible or in the Purana or in the Quran. That doesn't really matter. What you do is reserve a day for God. Reserve a day for the volunteer action, the action to unify in the consciousness, to unify in the soul, and not so much in acquiring and possessing, which is karma. So karma and dharma are opposite and unified in the word yoga. And in the unification of yoga, the karma is undone by dharma, so that we are a-karma. The danger is to be a-dharma, not to be of dharma. So let me talk about this dharma then. Dharma is also not easily translated into English. It is a term of its own. Dharma means several things. It means religiosity, righteousness, but also naturalness, or your own natural person, your own nature. So this is all dharma, the nature of something, the religiousness relating to God, and the righteousness of a state, and a way of behaving and behavior, is all dharma. But it is a complex concept. To be dharmic can also be an opposition. We have this opposition of dharma just as well in the East as we have it in the West. In the West we have this opposition of dharma, this disagreement about how to deal with the way to God. And that is in the West known as the opposition between the alternative spiritual people and the religious people. The religious people say New Age and spirituality and yoga, that's all crap, it's all cheating, because it doesn't liberate you at all. It isolates you and it drives you to the asylum. But that is not true. That is just politics of decrying a competitor. This is not fair. This is not true either. Even though they are right in saying that in spirituality your devotional service isn't directly clear. You are enlightened in your spirituality, but it's not clear to what community you belong, what kind of position of service you could acquire. So in India, this opposition between this spiritual and this religious approach is simply considered two types of dharma. There is pravriti dharma, as they call it, and nivriti dharma. So the word dharma we know, and the difference between religion and spirituality is a classical division of dharma we find in the oldest scriptures of India. There is this nivriti dharma of being free from material concerns. Material concern, a mind of material concern is vritti, a restless mind. And nivriti means free from that restlessness, free from that attachment of a materialistic mind. So you can be religious with this attachment or without this attachment. And if you're without this attachment, you are spiritual, easily, but more difficult of service, of a religion. And at the other hand, if you are pravriti dharma, if you are concerned with material affairs, pra is derived from prakriti, which is the material universe, and vritti, this concern, this mind of concern about it. So a religious attitude can be pravriti, can be concerned with material things, but not necessarily be of enlightenment, not necessarily be happy or even true. Because if we separate Dharma into these two groups, and if we start fighting one with the other, then we have no real Dharma at all. In fact, that is adharma. If you oppose an ego with the Dharma, it is not Dharma, it is adharma. Adharma means always to be of yoga, to be of integrity, and to see that there is enlightenment and liberation. So in philognosy, the real atma tattva, the real love of the soul, to the principle of the soul, which is the meaning of the word atma tattva, means that we accept both these dharmas. There is as well pravriti dharma as nivriti dharma. There is as well attachment as non-attachment. There is as well working in the week as being liberated from that in the weekend. So this is where the order of time is of relevance. That's why I discuss it at this site. Because we know we have this opposition between being liberated in devotional service and being enlightened to the principle of being nivriti, of being freed from all this concern and all this mindfulness about who's right and who's wrong. This is not the concern of the spiritual people. But it must be remembered, if we oppose the Dharma, if we say, as enlightened people, the religious ones of liberation are wrong because they are hypocrites, and if the religious people of religiosity say, well, these spiritual people are cheaters, what they do is simply a lie, because you're not liberated at all, you simply end up in the asylum. And thus you can denounce each other, decry each other's efforts, and thus be all unhappy, because you're all split up in a religious ego. And truly, we should have enough of this superego business. Freud said, from self, the primitive animal self, to ego is what we should. Well, we attained a lot of ego, but I say, from ego, there must also be a next step towards soul. So from S to ego is what Freud says, but what I say is from ego to soul. Based on our egos, we cannot unify. We cannot arrive at an organized world society of people who know their place and still have their individuality of culture and evolution, their own emancipation process, their own self-realization. This is only possible if we accept this essential discrimination between ego and soul, which is necessary to arrive at a proper integrity, to be unified properly. According these extra terms we imported from the Hindu culture, this yoga, this karma, and this dharma. We should be karma yogis, conscious of the unity of the dharma. Because also in dharma we can be opposites, we can be enemies even, decrying each other's efforts of arriving at this soul. So there may be many roads, and we have to respect that, but we also have to learn that we have to arrive at this integrity of dharma, at this integrity, this philognostic integrity of being liberated religiously, of being enlightened spiritually, but also being sober to the facts. And these are the facts of our language. And we discriminate between ego, self and soul, and between yoga, dharma and karma. And this is the essential point I would like to make today. I thank you for your attention.